it allows you actually to touch those atoms, and you could flip them, actually mess up with them, like you put your finger into the water. So that's the size. And now I'm going to return how the I'm going to explain a little bit how the quantum dots work. Okay. So when the electron returns from the lower level, the atom emits a photon of light with the same energy that the atom originally absorbed. So the color wavelength of the frequency of light atom emits depends on the atom. So let's say iron looks green when you excite it by holding them in a hot flame, while sodium looks yellowish, and because the energy level is wrenched. So the rule is different. Atoms give different colors. But all of the story is that if you come back to the old model of atoms, the planetary one, you could see that in the middle you have the nucleus, and then you have atoms, and then you have an electron, and then when you excite an electron, and then the electron is losing energy and coming back to its position, now it has to give the point of light. It has to give the light, and that light has a certain color in the electromagnetic spectrum. So that's how eventually we are able to have a full gamma of colors available for us. But a similar way to it is being used for our flat monitors. They are made from three basic colors. Dr. Roy, could you say more?
Well, AC2GS, I could say more, I could say less. The concept of color is one of, when we talk amongst each other, perception. Human beings have three color detection, red, green, and blue. And the way that electromagnetic waves go into our retina, we perceive the different percentages of all three of those as a spectrum of color. But there is a true spectrum of color that you see when you put a prism next to sunlight, the entire spectrum. In order for our eyes to perceive reasonable spectrum of color, you just need red, green, and blue, and you mix it together. Now, in the case of, I won't go into quantum mechanics too much, because I don't think anyone would want me to. Quantum dots are very interesting bits of technology. They're relatively easy to manufacture vast quantities at reasonably low prices once you figure it all out. It's just a matter of growing crystals at a given size. So you can grow them to be red and green and blue, and what you could do is line the back with a higher energy ultraviolet organic light emitting diode, and it shines onto a green quantum dot and reflects back green, or it goes into a red quantum dot and reflects red. And that's the way television set flat panels that have quantum dot or QD in their name use quantum dot technology to absorb a higher energy light and re-emit it as one of the three major colors in our light perception. It could be used for other things, but that's where we all know and love it. Many people out there even probably have a quantum dot television screen in their house. I don't. I still have LCDs from a previous generation, but quantum dot technology, both LCD-based and organic light emitting diode, are out there and very, very popular.
Actually, we can flip them too. So we have a molecule of one color, but you want to have not three basic colors and a mix of them that gives you a picture on your screen, but full gamma of colors can actually create the right molecule, I think. I could call it molecule. by you. I'm using the right terminology of color of your niche, Dr. Roy.
It's probably better to call them particles because they're not actually molecules. They're a cluster of atoms together in small substrates.
Thank you very much. Yes. But I felt them saying something. Anyhow, there is an application in medicine for it, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, there's a biological research being used, but I don't think it's diagnostic at this time. It's more of a research tool.
Yeah, also think about chemosensors, because we're talking about a picture that you could see on a monitor or a screen of our TV. We could say that previously that picture was made by sensors, by cameras, CCD cameras, the CMOS cameras, where image detecting chips have a pixels. You use them in digital cameras and webcams also, and they work similar way to solar cells by converting the incoming light into patterns of electrical signals. The efficient quantum dots could be used to make smaller and much efficient image. So we're talking about what was 10 years ago. We were 720 by 1080. That was high definition. But then it wasn't full high definition. Then it was 1080p by 1920. Then was 2K, and then it was 4K. Now we are about 8K, and most of the cameras are giving us 6K. So, in other words, why is that important? Let me jump. It is important that if you have a nice quality picture and you shrink it into lower resolution, still that information is there. So in other words, the quality of high definition pictures that will spring from 6K or 8K is much better than the original high definition, full high definition that you ever saw on your screen, even though that this is the same screen. So we talk about the same dots. You're not changing anything. You only think about the information that is in that pixel.
Okay, but I'm not quite sure what this has to do. Quantum dots doesn't really presently involve anything with higher resolutions. It's more of just a means of transforming one color from something that emits color, like an organic light-emitting diode or a regular light-emitting diode, into the color that you want. You always need to have a higher energy light source. What is somewhat important as far as quantum dots is because solar cells have preferred frequencies where they absorb energy and produce electricity, and a lot of that light that goes in is not the right frequency, you can use quantum dots to alter the frequency of the light and improve the efficiency of the solar battery. So that's an important thing that quantum dot technology is looking to solve.
What it has to do, the world of optics, quantum dots are being hailed as breakthrough technology in the development of more efficient solar cells. And when I was talking about CCD and CMOS, we're talking about the 10% of conventional semiconductors that are based on image detecting chips. And those include digital cameras and webcams. So they are way similar to the solar cells.
Okay, but I mean the point is the quantum dots will do something for the solar cells. CCD detectors don't necessarily, I don't know if they in practical terms, maybe in research terms, they can be researched for quantum dot usage. But for the most part, CCD and other sensors optical sensors don't employ quantum dots as far as I'm aware.
Well, it's good that we have different opinions because there is always a chance for me to learn something or for you to adjust eventually your knowledge in a certain area. And then we have the controversial. Let me drop. I would like to wrap it up because we have a limited time. So we have a subject that I reported. I have a problem with proper application of English words to Dr. Roy. That was about water explosion. I said a few words a few weeks ago about it. I'm going to touch the subject. So it appears to be that the explosion that has unexplained, or at least we think that it has unexplained mechanism. So that there were few attempts to explain it, but the strength we know that railgun is has application in military, and this explosion that has just a little drop of water is much stronger than railgun. So there is a number of papers that report experimental results which kinetic energy of cold fog created in water arc plasma exceeds the electrical energy supply from to form and maintain an arc. So the cold fog explosion is produced by breaking down the small quantity of liquid water. There is a professor, I sent the video to Dr. Roy. It's a Professor James, and he was working on it. There were two pieces of a copper, and he was using a spark where there was a water drop in between them, and in the right amount of water the explosion was enormous. I'm going to explain a little bit about it and then ask Dr. Roy for comments. Let me go.
Yeah, all we need is some palladium and deuterium.
Wesley?
No, we're talking about just water. Just water and spark. So, I'm going to give you the quote from one of the articles. The strength of the impulse has scaled proportionally to the dynamic action integral for the arbitrary chosen current, pulse shape, and magnitude. The plasma explosion in salt water is much more powerful than the action of the railgun. And for the railgun, we have the railgun could fire projectiles to intercept the incoming missiles. So some scientists argue that railguns could also protect Earth from the asteroids by firing high velocity projectiles from orbit. So now we have another form of launcher that manifests much more energy in it. There is also an explanation for the theoretical understanding why that happened. Dr. Roy stated that no, it is just energy of the spark. Dr. Roy.
Okay, Ed, feel free. Keep in mind that we're stepping all over Paul's time.
Oh, I need a couple of things. What do valves on spark have in common? That's all.
Gee, this is going to be a long one. We got to kind of cut it short. If you want to do it, bring it up again next week. It's my attitude. Number one, it's not a spark. It's an arc. There's a difference between a spark and an arc. Probably a couple of thousand watts. So what's going on is you're superheating the water with a high power arc and causing it to ionize. with explosive force. It's, you know, as I emailed to Wesley, it's not the bullet, it's the gunpowder. You know, it's not necessarily the rail gun projectile, it's the rail gun. All these things are supplying enormous quantities of potential energy onto something else. If I showed you a 2-ton boulder in the desert on the ground and asked you how powerful it would be, you would kind of look at me like I was crazy. If then I produced enough energy to raise it 2 miles high and said I'm going to let it go on top of you, then you're going to be very unhappy. So it's the potential energy, it's how you got the potential energy, that's the important part. Whether it's a bullet or a boulder or a drop of water, that's simply where you're dumping all the energy.
Okay, that's the point at which we have a different opinion. At first, water was not heated. It was completely cold. So there was not superheated anything, no vapor superheated whatsoever. And if I could use this wording, which sounds weird without an explanation, but with explanation, sounds pretty much reasonable, is that another article says it was found that water explosion do in fact release energy and can have efficiencies of greater than unity. The energy released during the explosion is like the difference between the heat capacity of bulk water or fog, or the water is cold. Those results allude at the possibility of harness water explosion from to perform work. Anyway, it says that the most likely explanation of the fog explosion is that they are caused by liberation of intermolecular bonding energy when bulk of water is transformed into the thinning fog droplets. Bonding is caused by both the hydrogen bonds of van der Waals forces and the energy stored by the bonds in roughly equal the latent heat of water. As it is found to be 2.3 kilojoules per gram at room temperature, the creation of large number of droplets is thought to be caused by mechanical effects of the electromagnetic forces in the arc discharge. So, a certain amount of mechanical energy is used to create the droplets and inconsequently stored a surface tension energy. That's the end of the quote. Back to you.
Okay, AC2GS, we're going to wrap this up for now. If I had the power, which I guess is a good thing I didn't, this is another group of people I would take their PhDs away from, just being downright foolish. You get yourself, you find someone you really hate, get an arc welder, have them put their fingers between the arc welder and turn the arc welder on. Now, their fingers were not superheated. Their fingers were room temperature. I don't think their fingers would be left much better room temperature after you turn the arc welder off. So it's the arc. It's the arc. It's not the covalent forces. It's not the Jiminy Juke. It's the damn arc. Anyway, let's table this for some later time. Thank you very much, Wesley. We really have to do the SpaceNet report.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Actually, you have to take the PhD from six scientists, and the other people listed on the material. I would like you just to, this week, because we're going to meet next week, to read the paper of the N. Krenau. He is from the Institution of Electrical Engineers, and that's the organization responsible for the standards in England, to say like IEE in here. Thank you very much. Have a good one.
Oh, my God. Nobel Peace Prize is about serving humanity, KG2RY.
Well, I don't know exactly that. In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. But again, that's another subject that we can. I'm certainly happy to take on next week. But it is 10:35, and it is long past where Paul is supposed to do the SpaceNet report. So, Paul, please come and do the SpaceNet report.
Okay. Very good. AC2GS, WS2N. And that's why my welding gloves really work good. I guarantee you get it between that spark. You want to have something on those fingers to protect those fingers. Anyway, yeah, good topics tonight. And by the way, Roy, I got those three websites, your three websites up. I got the link going, I got the stream going, I got the chat going. No problem. Most of it was operator error. Not on your end, from what I see. Left a dot out in there, you know. Correction, I put a dot in, you know, from after the word Limark, I kept putting a dot in, you know. Limark, dot tech. You can't do that. It's got to be Limark tech on all three. Right. So that's all good, Roy.
Very good. I'm glad to hear that. I had the same problem. I think I tried to do this 3-4 years ago, and I got a little resistance. People wanted to know how to spell Limark for some strange reason. So I said, oh, hell with it. I'll just use my personal call sign. But I thought I'd give it another go. And hopefully I'll get the links working the way they're supposed to. It didn't even occur to me to check that Gizmodo was going to block mask links. So I'll have a week to figure it out. But thanks for telling me that you were able to get through.
Very good. And, yeah. Interesting change. But very well done. A few things here for the SpaceNet report. This is WS2N. First thing is coming up in a couple of days, October 12th, which is, Thursday. They have a launch of the Psyche mission. That's the one that's going to go out to an asteroid with the same name, Psyche. You know, I've covered it many times here on the net, and I'm sure they'll probably mention it on the news. But right now, 24 hours of news is really dedicated to problems in Israel. So I'm sure it'll be on a computer somewhere. Psyche mission will be launched on a Falcon Heavy rocket from Florida. Now, Falcon Heavy rocket, anybody that listens to this net, we've covered that for many years, ever since they started launching these things. I think it's around the 8th time they're doing it. And it's one core stage, and then, you know, which is a Falcon 9 rocket, and then you take two rockets, put one on the side, one on the side. And they call it the Falcon Heavy. And, of course, on top of that, you have the second stage. So it's the largest rocket right now that we launch outside of the Artemis program, which NASA launched the end of last year. But this is the one that's really operational. It's by SpaceX, and they're going to send this thing out to the asteroid belt to investigate this 140-mile, not really diameter, it's not really a spherical shape, but they'll send it out there. It won't get there until August of 2029, so I got a long wait. There'll be some tests on the way. They're going to run a test passing another asteroid, make sure the cameras and all the scientific equipment work. So we'll see how the 6,000-pound thing, it's a heavy, large spacecraft. The solar panels itself are almost 80 feet across. So, you know, it's heavy, and that's why you need a Falcon 9. That's one of the reasons. You need that Falcon Heavy rocket to do it. Puts out 5.5 million pounds of thrust, almost as much as the space shuttle did. But with its big solar arrays that big, if you were to use it in Earth orbit, you know, which is relatively close to the sun, you know, at 1 AU, you would be getting 20 kilowatts out of it. By the time you get out to the asteroid belt, past Mars, halfway to Jupiter, between Mars and Jupiter, you're going to have
the inverse square law is going to cut that down to less than 4 kilowatts of power, but still quite a bit. It's like a home generator still powering this thing all the way out in the asteroid belt. Hopefully all goes well. It has a launch window of about 20 days, and a month or so ago, but it looked like there was going to be a problem because they were running a test on one of the nitrogen thrusters that they use on board the spacecraft. They were testing it in a lab somewhere, and they realized that it's getting on the hot side. And they checked the data and this and that for the company, and they realized that these things are getting hot. There's 12 of them on the, you know, actually on the spacecraft. They said that would be in danger of fouling up the mission. And they put their heads together and did a lot of tests, and they realized working at a 30% thrust of these little nitrogen thrusters, it would work. And what these nitrogen thrusters do, by the way, they adjust the attitude of the spacecraft. You know, you can change it, pitch your and all. With these thrusters, after testing it, they said this is going to be okay. They changed the software to only allow 30% of the thrust to come out of these things when they're in space. So they put it back on the timetable to launch on Thursday. Which I hope it goes up, because we've been talking about this for quite a few years now. NASA program, of course, with a big price tag of over $1 billion, I think it's $1.25 billion that has been put into Psyche. We'll see how it goes. It's got that laser communicator on board, which we're going to test out. I think we're going to test it out on the way to the asteroid belt, and maybe even when they're in orbit around this asteroid back in 2029. And the communication with laser, they're using infrared laser. We talked about this quite a few different nets, how they're going to do that. Transmit from Earth, signal is going to be picked up by Psyche, and that will in turn tell the thrusters which way to change the attitude to make that antenna, this 12-foot diameter antenna, point to Earth. So, and then it will transmit on using the laser infrared as well. We'll see how it goes. Should be good. It does have to get out there. After it's finally launched, it does have Hall effect thrusters as well. It's got four of them there. Ion transformers, ion thrusters, Hall effect thrusters. So we'll see how that is much more powerful than they've used in the past. Doesn't put out much thrust, but they're on all the time, and they can accelerate spacecraft at a very high speed and also slow down. Anyway, before I go on, any comments? WS2I.
I have a question.
Certainly. Is that Dave?
Good evening, Paul. This is David, KG2RY. I have a question. One, colonizing Mars, how doable is it within the next 5 years?
No, we're not going to be doing that in the next 5 years. If you would have asked some people 20 years ago, maybe they might have made it by maybe 2028. They might have said, 2028 would be good, but then that's not going to happen. They're working on, first of all, getting to the moon now, and once they establish that, which is going to take quite a few flights not only by NASA using the Artemis program, but also SpaceX using their their, what is it, the Starship, as well as the Amazon, they call that company Blue Origin. They have a vehicle that will be able to reach the moon as well. Once they establish that, then they can start thinking about colonizing the moon. They got a long way. There's a lot of infrastructure, things to be worked out. You know, I'm not expecting that. Minimum, I'm guessing 10 years, Dave. But that's my guess. Minimum, and when we talk about colonization, that's a lot of people. I mean, just to get four people there, which is the initial idea to do that, you know, 6 months there, spend a year there, and maybe another 6 months coming back. That would be flight number one. I'm figuring, I'm going to say 10 years from now. And I'm hoping for that. Back to you, Dave.
QSL. Well, I guess you got to get the people there. You got to have a way to sustain the life. So you probably have to build something, you know. The people are going to be inside, and they're going to be protected. You know, there is someone who sponsored this idea of colonizing Mars because of the state of this planet, and how to say, they want to say the consciousness of humankind, you know. They believe that this planet isn't going to last.
Yeah, that's pretty pessimistic. I don't know if you see some of these young kids today. I got grandkids. You go to some of the things they're doing in school. Just, you know, just terrific, you know. I'm pretty optimistic about the future. I don't think we have to go anywhere, but exploration-wise, yeah, I think we have to go. Back to you, Dave.
The warming will ensure the demise of this Earth.
Well, you know, it might be an idea for someone. Maybe there is some way to make money or to accomplish certain goals, you know. I hope that our planet will last, because I'm not going to Mars.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not going to Mars either unless I find out there's a Burger King opening there, but I don't think so. I haven't seen any cows walking around. I said that before. On Mars, you know, when they have the satellites going over, you know, like we have many satellites flying around them in orbit around Mars. When they look down on the surface with their lenses, they could see the size. If you had a coffee table on Mars, you'd be able to see it. But one thing you don't see is a bunch of cows walking around. So I guess you'd have to be a vegetarian. But we'll see. I just want to cover a couple of more topics, Dave. Let me do that, okay?
Go ahead. Thank you, Paul. Have a great night. When you're on Mars, you eat what's being served. 73 for now.
Okay, very good. They say the food on the International Space Station is actually pretty good. And it'll probably be like that for the moon as well. But we'll see. I mean, they've made so many improvements in the early days. When John Glenn would go up, they'd give him a tube and you squeeze the food out of the tube and it's god awful. You know. Anyway, there's a launch that just went up last week, a couple of days ago, from Florida, and it was the Kuiper satellites that went up. Kuiper satellites are broadband communication satellites. They're being built by Amazon, and Amazon is planning on putting up almost 4,000 of these things eventually. These are the first two of thousands to eventually be put up, and they're going to be trying to do that. But, you know, within 4 years or so, they would like to get all of their satellites up. It's going to be a direct competition with SpaceX, with Elon Musk's Starlink system. which that way ahead, of course, they've got I think it's over 5,000 satellites, but around a little less than that, 4,000 plus that are actually operational. But they're, you know, they're operating. They've got almost 2 million people signed up with their program. But this is a direct competition, and they're not the only ones. There's another one up there now called OneWeb. I don't know if anybody's signed up with them yet. I know they've gone through testing, and they're running around 600 satellites. Well, we'll see. And they're all designed to re-enter the atmosphere, SpaceX, as well as the Amazon Kuiper project. You know, if something goes wrong with the satellites, they're designed to de-orbit. So that means there's always going to be a constant replenishment of these things in the future. So Amazon has contracted out, I think, 50 or so launches with different companies to put these things into space, including their own. They plan on building the New Glenn rocket, which is another one of these things that's almost as big as the Saturn V, not quite, but massive rocket will eventually be flying from Florida. So they'll be launching up multiple satellites on that. These two satellites, they paid United Launch Alliance to put these two satellites up, because the New Glenn isn't ready yet. But even in the future, they plan on dealing with the United Launch Alliance. And when I say ULA like that, that's really Boeing and Lockheed. They work together on developing the Atlas V rocket. So this thing is launched, you know, almost 100 times, very successful during its lifetime. But they're going to retire that one eventually, and hopefully at the end, a new one will be flying by the United Launch Alliance. ULA will be putting up the Vulcan rocket, which will be the replacement for the Atlas V rocket. And we'll see how that goes. But the first two, it's something anyway. What you need up there is competition. You don't want a monopoly going. This is WS2S. Okay, we got a station down in Florida. It's been a couple of nets. He wanted to know about the OSIRIS-REx sample return mission. And this week, OSIRIS-REx scientists will be opening up the they call it the tag head, which was part of the OSIRIS-REx mission. They had a 7-foot arm sticking out of that satellite when they went to Bennu to collect samples. And this big round head, you know, the size of a frisbee, a little bit bigger, would, you know, touch down on the surface, shot a blast of nitrogen through, and that stirred up the material, and some of the material went inside this head, and, you know, calling it a head, they call it the tag unit, called the touch and go unit, touch and go head. So now it was inside of that, and in space, when it was still in orbit around Bennu, it took the arm and put it into a descent module inside of the mothership out of OSIRIS-REx, and eventually it flew back to Earth. It took another 2 years later. I mean, OSIRIS-REx launched in, I think, 2016. A couple of years to get to Bennu, stayed in orbit around Bennu for about 2 years, and then came back. And then last week or so, a week or two ago, it came back and landed in the Utah Army Proving Range desert out in Utah. Now, the scientists finally do have a hold of it. They've, you know, got it off the desert floor, put it into a C-17 cargo vehicle, and flew it to Johnson Space Center down in Houston, where they put it into this clean room, and that's where they're going to work on this thing. And hopefully on this Wednesday, they say at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, I'll turn on the NASA channel, that on, and they're going to open it up and find out how much material really is inside, and they'll get a preliminary idea of what's in there. It'll probably take months, if not years, to get, you know, real strong data on what the stuff is. What it is the stuff has not been touched since, I'm not going to say the beginning of time, but probably the beginning of the solar system. If you want to get a hold of that, find out if there's any little microbes in there. Or amino acids, actually, is what one scientist would love on one of the samples. So we'll see. If I'm home, I will definitely put that on. If not, I'm sure it'll be there's replays that NASA plays. You'll get it on YouTube. So that should be good. Any comments? WS2N. Okay. Another robot was returned to the International Space Station a couple of weeks ago. And it was set up on one of our cargo vehicles, which are docked in the space station. And they take out thousands of pounds of, like, these things send up, maybe 6,000 or 8,000 pounds of cargo. And one of the things that they took out on that last delivery was something called the honey astrobee. It's a big cube, maybe about a little over 12 inches on each side, and it's a flying robot, really a flying computer. And it's designed to work inside the International Space Station. What they do is it has these fans on it, and it can fly from one module to another module to the International Space Station. It has a docking port. They put a docking port up inside the Kaibo module. That's the Japanese module. One of the 16 different modules that are on the space station. And you got to understand, the space station is as big as a five-story building or a house with five big rooms.
That time
complete. So one of these modules is this docking port, and this big thing, this 1 foot cube, attaches to the docking spot, along with two other ones. The other two are still up there. So there's a total of three. This one was sent back for repairs a couple of years ago. But now they have all three back. And what their capabilities are they can undock themselves. You can tell it, go to this module. It will fly from one module to the next using little fans, different fans on the different sides of this cube, so it can change its attitude, and it's got cameras on board. It could assist the astronauts in doing something. It could look for a tool. I'm an astronaut. I put my meter down and my wrench down somewhere, and I don't know where it is. This thing will search through the space station and look for it. That type of thing. So it's a robot that gives assistance to the astronauts. It's like a second generation of these things. They set something similar up to it years ago. They call them the spheres. They were round ones. Maybe it's about as big as a soccer ball. But they retired them. They bought those back, and they sent up. They call them honeybees. They're different names. They have the queen bee, and anyway, there's three of these things. I remember one of the astronauts, McLean, she had opened the first one back in 2016, and McLean, and they've been operating them on and off in the space station ever since. It's pretty cool. The ultimate goal, of course, would be eventually have robots doing work not only inside the space station but outside the space station. And they do have plans for that, but that might be some years away if they do it at all. They would love to have that. Let's see, doing a trip to Mars. something goes wrong on the outside of the space station. You really want to do a spacewalk, you know, six months away from Mars, away from Earth, and, you know, maybe a month right before you orbit Mars. You would like to do a repair. You have a robot on the outside, you know, turn them on, program them, and let it do its work. That's one of the ultimate goals of robotics in space. Anyway, we have a few other things on the list, but we can go through that. We'll do that next week, no problem. I think I covered the main topic. So I'm going to turn it back to Roy. We'll be on tomorrow night. Anybody listening, Weimark, ClubNet will be on these frequencies at 8 o'clock, like this net is. Roy, I'm going to turn it over to you. AC2GS, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Thank you very much, Paul. This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul, for the SpaceNet Report, for all that you do on the technical net and all that you do for the club. You all appreciate it, and I especially appreciate it. I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. Thanks for coming. Thanks for talking. I hope people learned some things and unlearned some other things and had a good time. And I hope most of you will come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. So with that in mind, I'll leave you with my usual comments about our rebels now are done. And Dick would often end his technical nets with the excellent advice, be kind to each other. And I always like to mention good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep your mind open. Try to learn some new and interesting things. By the way, I learned that Google really does not like masked forwarding of links. So I unmasked it, and if you check links.limarktech.net, it looks a little uglier on the top, but the links do work. And I'll investigate if there's any other options to kind of hide its real identity. We'll see. Anyway, have a great week. Have a wonderful Columbus Day tomorrow. Enjoy yourself. It's still a little on the warm side, so enjoy what warmth we have before it starts to turn cold. If you haven't gone for your flu and COVID vaccinations, please go for them. For your own sake, and everyone be well, be kind, and as I often add these technical nets, and I hope I won't have to eventually, Slava Ukraine. This is AC2GS, formally closing this Columbus Day weekend live our technical net. Everyone, have a great time. I am clear.
KE2AJU. Enjoy your week.
If anybody wants to know about the buck converter I was talking about earlier, WB2CQT, the name is DROK, and the website is droking.com, DROKING.com. They sell all kinds of buck converters.
AC2GS, WB2BS, so if you're still there.
Thank you. W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Temperature 50 degrees.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 4:55 a.m. Mostly clear. Temperature 46 degrees.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Fly Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 5:01 a.m. Mostly clear. Temperature 46 degrees.
W2VL repeater.
Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 6 a.m. Mostly clear. Temperature 46 degrees.
W2VL repeater.
Yes, sir, baby! fucking all right.
What?
Say again.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 7 a.m. Mostly cloudy. Temperature 45 degrees.
W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 7:55 a.m. Partly sunny. Temperature 47 degrees.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.
Flymark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.